ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
People have woken up to the fact you can have a wonderful lifestyle, and we've worked very hard on our local infrastructure. You can commute for 3 minutes rather than an hour a day each way. That's attractive too.
The secret's out. Regional towns across the country provide an attractive lifestyle. But the flow and effects of Australians moving to the country or heading to seaside towns has big consequences, from homelessness to skyrocketing prices. We'll head to the regional town that's just recorded the highest jump in house prices of any regional centre in the country. And later in the program, America's conscientious consumers are putting Aussie goat on the menu. I'm Alex Barwick and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Aranda Country in Mbantua Alice Springs, bringing you stories from across regional and remote parts of the country. We head first to Albany. The dream of owning your own home has seen many Australians head to the regions to embrace sea or tree change and find something affordable. But high demand and skyrocketing prices are now all too real in regional Australia. The picturesque coastal community of Albany in southwest WA has recorded the highest growth in house prices across regional Australia. Reporter Rhys Jones is based in Albany and has the story. Rhys, good to talk to you on Australia Wide. What sort of a jump have you seen in house prices?
A report has just come out from Cotality, and in the last 12 months alone to September, Albany house prices have risen by 22.2%. That puts the median price just over $698,000, up from $571,000. It's quite staggering growth, really.
And so what does that mean for anyone who's trying to buy their own home, particularly entering the market for the first time?
Like so many spots around the country, it's extremely difficult to buy right now. And when a buyer, you know, heads to a home open and there may be 50 or more people looking at the same spot, it can give a sense of hopelessness at times. Yeah, we spoke to Nina Salvatore, who's been working as a nurse around the country, and since coming to Albany has been looking for a place to call home, and has been going to those home opens, you know, looking to stay in the town as a health worker, and is just finding it really difficult to find that first spot.
When I've gone to a house inspection, there's already like 50 other people there, and it just feels almost pointless because it feels like someone else will put in a bit offer over what they're asking. The other side of that as well is some of the places they're asking for quite a lot of money for either a smaller place or a place that's quite run down, and then feeling that pressure to sort of know that I want to buy that quickly. Like, it feels there's the pressure of being like, oh, there's 50 other people here. I'm not 100% sure on this house, but if I don't put in an offer, am I going to miss out?
Yeah, and that was Nina Salvatore sharing her experience there.
Rhys, what has caused this record hike in house prices in Albany?
Well, it looks to be a bit of a 1-2 punch for Albany. On the one hand, demand has really risen quite quickly, just because people have fallen in love with Albany, and that desirability for the town has gone up. In the other hand, there's been a decrease or stagnation of supply, just because they don't have the lots of land to expand onto. And I spoke to local realtor Kyle Sprockton, and he unpacked those two issues.
It comes down to supply and demand, really. So probably the lowest stock levels almost on record, certainly this century, I would have thought. So the secret's out now with COVID. You know, we're all able to sort of work a little bit more remotely, or we've all looked at our lives and decided what's important. And so, you know, the secret of Albany is now well and truly out, and people just sort of have fallen in love with the lifestyle, and then add in a whole host of other things, and we find ourselves in this position.
And that was local realtor Carl Sproxton.
Rhys, so clearly there's a double-edged sword to people realising that places like Albany are beautiful and provide a really desirable lifestyle. Is there anything that can be done, though, whether it's in the short term or long term, to see those prices come down or at least stay where they are?
Well, it's a balancing act between keeping what people have fallen in love with and why people love Albany, and opening those new lots up to stop that growth and allow people to have somewhere to live. The mayor has said that there are some lots in the pipeline.
There are around 720 homes. That is before the WAPC right now. And the proponent is hoping that those lots can start to come on in the market in the next 12 to 18 months. That is a big part of the puzzle while other things happen.
And speaking of those other developments, the mayor also says that they're keen for support from the federal government so they can get those bigger areas online.
What we need is support from the government, which we'll talk to them about, is to get the infrastructure in to open up that land so that prices don't escalate too far.
Yeah, that was the mayor, Greg Stocks. There are some instances, and I'm sure this happens in many regional towns, but here in Albany I spoke to one couple in particular, and they sold their home not to the highest bidder, but to another young family who wanted to keep the community alive and keep the connections that they'd formed with their neighbours alive with another young family. So, you know, putting a human face on it and talking to those sellers can have a positive effect.
Rhys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Reporter Rhys Jones in Albany.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
We head to Barcaldine now in central west Queensland. For those living with a disability, accessing vital support is an ongoing challenge in the regions. So when a new company opened up in outback Queensland late last year promising mobility products, residents were keen to purchase crucial equipment like walkers and wheelchairs. But now those same residents say they've been left hung out to dry. Hannah Walsh has this story.
Russell Burns can't drive and struggles to walk. He hobbles into town on crutches and some days can barely leave the house. The 64-year-old lives in the small town of Barcaldine in central west Queensland, where getting the mobility equipment he needs can be challenging.
I've been on crutches for, I don't know how long, I've been for quite a while. And it's because of my knees. When I walk, if I don't have the crutches, my knees give away and I fall ass over head.
So when a business promising to transform product accessibility in the bush started servicing the outback last year, Russell wasn't the only one that placed an order. With a home support grant through Youngcare, Russell purchased a $6,300 scooter from Remote Mobility. But 6 months later, he's still waiting for it. He says he's been unable to reach the business or its owner, Christopher St. Clair.
Then they just disappeared. I never heard from them. That's when I tried to, I left him a couple of messages. And I said to him, I said, on the message, I said, well, where the hell are you? I said, where's my scooter? I said, I want my bloody scooter. And I never heard back. Because there's people in town who ask me where I've been. I just say, well, I've been at home. I said, I don't have a scooter. I said, I can't go far. So I can go with a decent once I leave here. I've got to stop and let my breath catch up. So there's days where I come home, I've got to pull up, I'm buggered on the way home. So by the time I get here, that's it, I'm knackered, I'll just lay in the lounge and go to sleep.
In Isisford, a tiny town about an hour's drive south of Longreach, Belinda Avery lives with cerebral palsy and relies on mobility equipment to get around. She's been waiting 9 months for a walker she paid for through her NDIS package.
I want them standing up walkers. You put your arms over side. Want me to walk straight. I've been down on them little ones. And nothing happened. I asked them all the time. They don't know what happened.
Her mum, Jocelyn Avery, says it's extremely disappointing.
Not just for Belinda, but I believe they did this to many other people out here with disabilities.
Police say Mr. St. Clair told them the business is insolvent. The ABC has been unable to get in contact. Katie Green is the manager of Outback Independent Living, the peak body for people with disability in Western Queensland.
Remote Mobility wanted to bring out their trailer with all of their products to do a product show at our Disability Expo last November, and they got in touch with us directly over Facebook, and then they came out to our expo in November last year in Longreach. I guess they knew the need and they knew the problem that they were trying to solve, which is why I think it made sense for us to engage them. I think a lot of people in remote communities, they go without. And that's really disappointing to hear when you think about the positive aspects of accessing your community, being able to get out and get around, the wellness and health benefits of doing that. You know, that we know of people in communities such as Winton and Blackall who are going without equipment who really need it.
On a website that no longer exists, Remote Mobility assured customers they provided a thorough and tailored experience that genuinely cares for remote communities. The website also said they were in the process of becoming an NDIS registered business.
So for some people, the piece of equipment might be a few hundred dollars. For Russell, we were looking, I've got the invoice just here, was just under $6,000. For other people, the servicing and maintenance, it could be a contract for 12 months of service delivery, which could be up to $10,000. So we know that the value of some of these services and goods was you know, added up to something quite significant. And for someone like Russell, he's not eligible for the NDIS. He's not eligible for My Aged Care. So when you look at his unique situation, you couldn't get someone more vulnerable.
Miss Green contacted Remote Mobility in March to purchase the scooter and says she was last contacted in May to say the product was ready to be delivered.
Within a few weeks of no contact, we actually contacted the manufacturer of those goods. And it was at that point in time that we found out the goods were never ordered through them, they were never paid for, they were never delivered to Remote Mobility.
On the Australian Business Register, Mr. St. Clair has registered 3 healthcare businesses since February 2021. His ABN has been cancelled since August this year.
When you look at this sort of situation, it just reminds us that when you're looking at engaging a provider, it's about doing your research. It's about getting references.
Katie Green from Outback Independent Living, ending that report from Hannah Walsh.
ABC Australia Wide.
Let's head now to the red dirt of WA's northwest. It's one of the most resource-rich places in the world, pumping out gas and iron ore. It's also home to pristine and unique landscapes and holds long-term, ongoing cultural significance for Indigenous people. So the tension between industry and environment is keenly felt. And in the Kimberley region, that tension is coming to a head in a renewed debate about hydraulic fracturing, referred to as fracking. Reporter Ruby Littler is in Broome. Thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Yeah, of course.
Ruby, why is fracking back in the spotlight now?
I guess fracking is particularly back in the spotlight at the moment ahead of the Labor State Conference this weekend that's being held in WA. And that's a meeting of a lot of kind of party faithful where they gather to discuss the future of the party and policies and also to debate some of those key things. And it's thought that this will be on the agenda, the matter of fracking, because we hear about it a little bit over here in WA. So it's a term that's keenly known and felt, especially among environmentalists who continue kind of lobbying for that full statewide ban.
Now, fracking is wildly different depending on what state or territory you're in. What are the current rules around fracking in Western Australia and in particular in the Kimberley?
Yeah, so basically an Environmental Protection Agency review of fracking practices was handed down in WA in 2018, and that concluded that fracking risks could be managed, but under strict regulations, and there were a total of 44 recommendations that were handed down. And essentially, the result of that today is that about 2% of WA is still open to fracking on existing petroleum titles, and those are in the Kimberley and the Midwest. And then you've got a ban or a moratorium that which protects the remaining 98% of the state.
Ruby, remind us exactly how fracking works.
Basically, the term fracking, it's shortened, as you kind of mentioned, for hydraulic fracturing. And that's a process by which oil and natural gas are extracted from beneath the ground, essentially, and you've got a drill that's going deep into those rock layers and pumping in a high pressure blend of water and sand and chemicals to kind of open those fracture points, and it allows trapped oil and gas to flow to the surface for extraction. And that's where you really see those environmental groups and traditional owners here as well, from different parts of the Kimberley, and they're sounding those alarms about the potential long-term impacts of that on the unique landscape up here.
Yeah, tell me a bit more about what those who oppose fracking are saying.
Yeah, so I guess the main messages that we're hearing from those opposing fracking really come down to the fact that the unique landscape up here needs to be protected. And we've spoken with various traditional owners who reiterate that message that they want their country to be clean like it was when they grow up. They don't want fracking. They want that statewide ban. We also spoke with an environmental group, Environs Kimberley, and their chief executive, Martin Pritchard, said while 2% might sound like a pretty small number, it's actually that area that's open to fracking in WA is nearly the size of Tasmania. Have a listen to what Martin Pritchard has to say.
And what we're calling for, obviously, is we want to see the Kimberley protected from this really invasive industry. What we're saying is this is not an industry that's compatible with the globally significant natural values of the Kimberley. And we need a ban, and we need it next week. Does the WA Labour Party want to be responsible for opening up the Kimberley to one of the most invasive, polluting industries on the planet? That's the big question facing them.
And that was Martin Pritchard there, who we spoke to from Environs Kimberley.
And so what has been the response to these kind of calls for a ban on fracking?
Yeah, so we've spoken with the WA Chamber of Minerals and Energy that don't support any kind of blanket ban on any sort of mineral and energy commodity development. And a large part of that is because, you know, as you mentioned up top, the resources sector, especially in WA, it's the backbone of the state's economy, and anything that could potentially deter future investments from international trading partners, you know, that kind of raises some of those alarm bells. And we also have our Premier, Roger Cook, who says WA already has some of the tightest laws around fracking in the country. And we asked him, you know, what is the current status of those kind of legislation, and also what he anticipates will be discussed at the state conference this weekend.
Oh, well, look, the state conference is a democratic forum of the Labor Party, so it will make its own decisions. We continue to have the tightest laws in the country in relation to fracking. It's banned across 98% of Western Australia's landmass, and landowners and traditional owners have the capacity to veto any production on their land. So we've got incredibly tight rules around protecting our environment from the more exotic means of extracting gas like fracking.
That was Premier Roger Cook there talking about, yeah, some of the laws that are currently in the state around fracking, but it wasn't 100% accurate what he mentioned so far as traditional owners and landowners currently having that veto power, which he referred to. It's something that the government has promised, but it hasn't actually been legislated, and there's no timeline as to when that will occur.
So, Ruby, what happens now? What's the future of this ongoing debate about fracking in Western Australia?
Yeah, so right now we've got Texas-based Black Mountain Energy through its Australian subsidiary, but they've submitted a proposal to the EPA to drill and frack up to 20 wells in the Canning Basin. Now, on their website, you know, they say that the Canning Basin is one of the largest undeveloped gas reservoirs in the world. It's 120 kilometres southeast of Derby in the West Kimberley region, so it's really front of mind at the moment, and that proposal is currently going through the processes of the EPA's approval. And that's kind of another reason, I guess, why environmentalists are continuing to kind of flag this, because it's a reality that could happen, on their doorstep.
Ruby, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Reporter Ruby Littler in Broome. My name's Alex Barwick. You're listening to Australia Wide, bringing you stories from across regional and remote parts of the country. Still to come on the program, there's a surge in international demand for wild-caught goat. Australian goat meat has become the first choice for America's conscientious consumers. But what does it mean for breeders back home? But next, we'll head to the central coast of New South Wales, where homelessness is on the rise.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
Earlier in the program, we were in Albany in southern WA, the town where houses have skyrocketed in price so much so they've broken a record for regional Australia. But these sky-high housing prices are hurting communities across the country and pushing more and more people into homelessness. We head to the central coast in New South Wales now to meet a group of residents now living in a park because they have nowhere else to go. Janae Madden has this story.
The entrance is one of the prettiest spots on the New South Wales central coast. Beaches to the east and the lake to the west. A retirement town. A holiday escape. and for some, now, it's a place to survive.
April, May, June, July, August.
Picnic Point Reserve sits right on the lakefront, a grassy park where dozens of tents, cars and caravans are now wedged between the picnic tables and the water's edge. That's where I met Kat. She's 50, a cleaner, and has been living here for almost a year.
Homeless? Yeah, bad situation. And, yeah, we came back here, we went to friends' places, we stayed in motels. Came down here. It's like just somewhere safe to sleep, somewhere to be.
Kat grew up at the entrance. She says even with work, rent and bills have outpaced her pay.
And that's like, you know, where do you, you know, even if you do work, like, which would be hard, it's like, where do you, you know, like, you need somewhere to go, somewhere to be when you've done that for the day, you know, when your day's done and where do you go?
Kat says she's tried the support services, but the help often runs out before the problem does.
You can jump through all the hoops and still get nowhere, and that on the promise that you're going to get somewhere, and that, but I mean, really, I mean, was it linked to homes? That only lasts for 28 days, I think, and that, and then it's like you can reapply, but I mean, they're not going to look at you real happy sort of thing, I don't think, because, you know, it's like, oh, you failed, but you're back again, and that, and it's like, well, you know, hoops are a bit high.
Parked up near the boat ramp is Mars, a 52-year-old former brick cleaner.
Six months. I got the year there. I got no tent or nothing. So I was mobile. I was just go everywhere. But this is what I used to say.
So what is your situation? What are you sleeping in?
I just sleep in the car for now.
Muzz says rents on the coast have shot up faster than he can keep up.
Like, my rent was only $380 originally, and overnight it went up to $480.
Mars says he even tried to get budgeting help, but was told he didn't qualify.
I went and done a budget thing, and they said that couldn't help me because I didn't earn enough money. And I said, that's why I'm here, to do it.
It's a story becoming all too familiar across regional New South Wales. People who were just getting by now finding themselves priced out completely. And all across the state, encampments are popping up from the Illawarra to the North Coast.
It's getting a lot worse.
That's Homelessness New South Wales CEO Dominique Rowe.
We know that the cost of living pressures are really putting a bite on people. That means that people are having to cut costs in a whole range of ways, whether or not that's cutting back on groceries and sometimes, unfortunately, on paying the rent.
She calls the situation a crisis and says across the state, numbers show a real spike since before COVID.
On the Central Coast, it's pretty bad as well. We know that rough sleeping is up in the last 5 years by 144%.
The Central Coast Council, which manages this reserve, says its powers are limited to address the situation. David Farmer, the council's CEO, says local government can't provide housing, but they can assist with rubbish.
We don't have the power to move people on, and the State Homelessness Protocol also indicates that homeless people have the right to be in a public space the same as anybody else.
State MP for the entrance, David Meehan, says he feels for the growing community.
The people who are camping at Picnic Point is the physical expression of how bad housing has been managed over the last 10, 20, 30 years.
He says for now there are no plans to move campers on, much to the dismay of fierce community groups. Back at Picnic Point, Kat says she knows not everyone is happy about the encampment, but she hopes people can look beyond the hard rubbish, tents and caravans.
You can't look down on people because of where they live or what they haven't got. I don't know, it's just like we might as well just all label ourselves shit and be done with it. And that, you gotta have humanity, you gotta have empathy, you gotta have sympathy, you gotta care about people to want to, you know, like, if, I don't know, none of us want to be here, but we all, you know, like, we've all got a reason to be here.
Would you say you're a resilient person?
I challenge anyone to do it here for about a week or two. Yeah, because it's like you're always digging through a bag of clothes. You know, like it takes so long just to do everything, and then you got to lock up everything you own in a Ziploc bag and go to the shop. And it's like, and everything means so much because it's all you got, and everything takes so much time. And then, yeah, it's like Well, I'm thinking how long Mars is staying here. It's like months to slip away.
That's Kat, a camper at Picnic Point, ending that story from ABC Central Coast's Janae Madden.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
And finally, it's time for a bit of this. Yes, goat is on the menu. Australian goat meat has become the first choice for America's conscientious consumers, who see it as a more environmentally sustainable and healthy option than other meats. The surge in international demand for wild-caught rangeland goats comes as producers seek to improve quality through dedicated breeding programs. Madeline McCosker filed this report.
Goat meat production is up, jumping 47% in just 1 year. Figures from Meat and Livestock Australia show most of that is exported to countries like the US, South Korea, China and the Caribbean. Dr. Janine Teese is a senior analyst with supply chain consultancy Greenleaf Enterprises. She says driving that demand is a quality-focused segment of the market known as conscious consumers.
And typically within that conscious consumer, it's about environmental sustainability, how it was raised, different management activities involved in it, and also the use of hormones, growth promotants, antibiotics. And goat fits that conscious consumer perfectly, which is why we've seen in the likes of California and the US a massive demand for goat meat.
Research from MLA shows that only 5% of Australian goat meat finds its way into the domestic market. Through her work with different supply chains, Dr. Teese said consistent supply of meat needs to be a priority.
Having the ability to have weekly supply all year round is something that a lot of the domestic supply chains have been working to build. If we've identified, like, there's an opportunity in those cuisines which are growing and people are looking for, then how do we make sure that the goat producers in Australia are able to supply into that market? Because once you're on the menu, you've got to be able to supply for that quantity that they need and consistency.
As the industry works to ensure reliable supply in Aussie butcher shops, consistency in taste is also key. In the 1990s, declining beef consumption prompted the red meat industry to develop Meat Standards Australia, or MSA. It's a voluntary national eating quality system, which was extended to lamb in 2021. The system works to ensure the eating quality of red meat and allows meatworks to provide feedback to producers. But nothing has been developed for goat meat. Some within the industry are hoping this year's introduction of mandatory individual electronic identification, or EID tags, in goats could be the start of a similar system for goat meat. Glenda Henry is chair of Queensland Goat Producers, and she also breeds goats in central Queensland.
The only advantage for us in actually EID tagging them, because there's a lot of expense in that, would be actually getting proper kill sheets like you do from, you know, you get your reports back from your cattle, but you don't from your goats. Until you've actually got grading, there's no guarantee when you go to buy goat meat what you're going to actually get. If they have a bad experience, you're never going to get them to go back again.
But not all goat producers agree that it's a priority. Anita Dennis is a Western Queensland goat producer, and she thinks consistent supply into supermarkets should be the industry's priority.
I really don't think MSA grading is really driving the goat industry at the moment. The butchers, when I go away, I pop in there and I speak to them. I ask them about, you know, do you think we need MSA grading for goats? And to tell you the truth, they just want product on the shelf. So it's something that isn't there within the market. I think there's so many other things that the goat industry needs before MSA grading.
The Goat Industry Council of Australia works with government to develop policy for the sector across all breeds. Its president, John Falkenhagen, says the organisation has no position on MSA grading, but whatever system is developed needs to be fit for purpose.
MSA may not work for the goat industry because of the way that it's cooked, the way that its supply chains work. But we may have something else that's unique, and I can't define that. That will happen over time.
John Falkenhagen, president of the Goat Industry Council of Australia, ending that report from Madeline McCosker with additional reporting from Megan Hughes. And that's Australia Wide for today. My name's Alex Barwick. Remember, you can podcast the show or listen back to the program through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC Australia Wide. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen.